Good afternoon. I want to thank you all for still being here. It's a beautiful day outside. If I was you, I would find it really hard. Anybody in here work in a community health center? So you'll keep me honest. I was hoping nobody would raise a hand and I could say whatever I wanted and wouldn't have to worry about it being tested. What I want to talk about is how community health centers can help contribute to the delivery of clinical preventive services. Ned talked about what clinical preventive services are, and I think we have tried collectively to increase the delivery of those services through community health centers. And then I'm going to talk a little more specifically about how in Denver we've used our community health center network to deliver what I think is a high level of clinical preventive services. So a little background on health centers. Health centers started out as a demonstration program back in, many years ago. This is back in Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty. And to my knowledge, there are only two programs that are still in existence to this date that were started back then. One of them are community health centers. What's the second one? Head Start. You're very good. The Head Start program, and they both have community boards that have recipient involvement on the boards. Their community health centers are celebrating their 45th year of operation. They operate throughout the country, urban, rural, migrant areas. They're administered, authorized under a federal grant program in the Public Health Service through the Bureau of Primary Health Care. And in fact, Dr. Wakefield, who's HRSA administrator, the Bureau of Primary Health Care sits with her, and I'm sure she'll be talking some about community health centers. We're authorized annually at about a little over $2 billion a year for health centers. In the next 5 years, that will increase significantly so that it will be close to $4 billion a year within the next 5 years. And the belief is that infusion of funding for community health centers will increase access to primary care for vulnerable populations and thereby increase the delivery of health services, including clinically preventive health services. There are approximately 1,200 grantees around the country. Denver Health, that I'll talk about later, is one of the grantees, and they represent what I think is a unique kind of private-public partnership. If you think about health centers, there are five essential elements of what you need to do to be a health center. One, you need to be in a high-need area. You have to demonstrate that you're in a medically underserved health professional shortage area and you have a medically underserved population. You have to provide a comprehensive set of health services. You have to provide services to all residents in the community wherein the health center resides, regardless of income, and you have to provide that on a sliding fee scale based on people's income. And all of the health centers, as I mentioned earlier, are governed by community boards. So every health center has to have the board composed of at least 51% of the members of the board being people who receive services through the health center. That's a really tried and true element of the Health Center Act, and I think we believe it contributes greatly to the success of health centers. And we all have to follow a set of performance reporting requirements that are outlined by the Bureau of Primary Health Care and apply equally to all health centers. So we have a set of clinical and fiscal and productivity measures that we have to report on to justify receiving the federal funding that we receive. Health centers today provide care to a large number of American citizens, particularly low-income citizens. One in four low-income uninsured people in this country receive their care from health centers. One in four low-income children. One in seven rural Americans receive their care from health centers. And a large number of farm workers and homeless persons receive their care from health centers. And we expect that. Interesting question is, what is it going to be in 5 years? The National Association of Community Health Centers would like to say or says that they believe that we can do 40 million individuals in 5 years based on increased funding and growth of the health center movement. This is a pretty typical diagram of patients who receive care in a health center. In what kinds of services they receive. Large percentage of medical services, but also behavioral health services, which is growing considerably in the last few years, oral health services, and enabling services, which are a unique component of most health centers, which really are services that allow people to take access of the other services that are available through the health center. So outreach workers, care coordinators, patient navigators, promotoras, whatever you want to call this, there are a number of different groups that are help people access care. These are the services that have to that are offered through health centers, and in fact are services that must be operated through a health center, either directly on site or by contract with another entity. So it's theoretically possible that you could not offer oral health services at your site, but you'd have to make arrangements for your patients to get oral health services elsewhere. Same thing with prenatal care. Not all health centers provide prenatal care, but they have an arrangement in place for their users to get prenatal care at another site. Patients in health centers tend to be sicker and have more chronic disease than other patients, and a large number of visits in health centers are for chronic disease management, which although I know not directly part of clinical preventive services, are a necessary component to keep people healthy and more active and able to live longer with their disease. And almost a quarter of the visits to health centers are now are for things like diabetes, asthma, cardiovascular disease, et cetera. The other thing that's of interest, and I think many people don't think of health centers as doing this, but almost a third of the visits to health centers are for what would be considered clinical preventive services: cervical cancer screening, breast cancer screening, well, child care, immunizations, prenatal care. This is a very substantive part of what health centers do. And over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of work on health centers to improve performance in both of these areas, both in the delivery of chronic disease management and in the delivery of chronic preventive services through health disparities collaboratives work, through breakthrough series that have been sponsored by the Bureau of Primary Health Care in conjunction with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. This is a sense of who patients are that take care, that are in health centers, the red bars being health center patients, the black bars being the general population. So you can see that although only 36% of the population, only, I mean, in fact, 36% of our fellow citizens live under 200% of poverty, most of the patients in community health centers are under 200% of poverty. So this is a very, we tend to take care of low-income groups, non-white groups, patients on public insurance, or patients who are uninsured. And we have a high incidence, again, the red bar are health center patients, high incidence of diabetes, high incidence of hypertension, asthma, mental health disorders. So you can see that for that population, these are the services we need to address. The other unique thing about health centers is no single health center is the same, and it depends very much on the local environment within which they exist, because they develop unique partnerships with their local entities to provide services to the population. And I think that's, again, another unique thing about the health center model is it's very local. Most healthcare, I think, is local. How we organize, how we deliver is very locally determined, despite federal and state policy. Denver Health is a unique health center in that we have the health center embedded within a public entity. There are about 5% of the health centers in the country are what they are called public entity health centers, where the grantee is a public entity like a health department, or like our, in our instance, a health and hospital district, where we apply for the federal funding in partnership with a community board. So I always tell people I have the unique joy of being able to report to two people. I can report to our CEO of the Health and Hospital Authority, and I report to my community board. Either one of them can fire me, which is always nice to know. We have integrated within our system of Denver Health the community health centers and the school-based health centers, but also the public hospital, the local health department, and a number of other entities to serve the needs of the patient population. We are, by statute, a governmental subdivision of the state of Colorado with a mission to serve the underserved in Denver and a contract with the city of Denver to provide services to the low-income population. We have the characteristics of our delivery system is we have essentially an employed medical staff that provides care in all of our sites of care with both a service mission and an academic mission where affiliated with the University of Colorado, and we're a teaching hospital. We have a single medical record, so when you enter the system, no matter where you enter the system for care, whether it's in one of our school-based health centers, whether it's in one of our community health centers, whether it's at the hospital, as soon as the newborn is born, they have a unique record number that follows them throughout the system. And we're linked electronically, so all sites have access to the same clinical information, no matter where you go for care. And we have, I think, spent a fair amount of money to develop a robust information system that allows us to manage care better. We have one federal grant for our community health centers and school-based health centers. This is Denver Health, which is the slide it around. Thank you. The family health centers and the school-based health centers are what I'm going to talk about next, which is really our FQHC sites. But we also have other sites that are components of Denver Health. We have the medical center, we have the public health department, we have a managed care plan, we have a public inebriate program, a non-medical detox, we provide jail care. So we provide a lot of services around Denver under one unique umbrella called the Denver Health and Hospital Authority. And then we have our community health center network, and this is our FQHC network, which consists of our health centers, our school-based health centers, some urgent care centers, a hospital-based women's care center, and many public health programs that traditionally are delivered through health departments. So I like to show this diagram, which is really a diagram that shows all the components of our FQHC network that are under one umbrella to meet the needs of patients. So I've mentioned many of them already. The ones in yellow are programs that are essentially public health funded. So we receive, well, by contract with the state of Colorado, the Department of Public Health and Environment, we operate the WIC program, we operate a women's cancer screening, breast cancer, cervical cancer screening, public, and we have a van that goes around the sites, the nurse home visitor program, our Title X family planning program, EPSDT, children with special health care needs. There are others I could probably add on here. We have an immunization outreach program that we have state funding for where we go around and do community-based immunizations. Now, all of this stuff operates under our FQHC network to meet patients' needs. I might say, parenthetically, although I think this works well to seamlessly provide services to patients without them knowing where the funding comes from, it sometimes drives us crazy in trying to figure out how we have to report back to these people who want to know what they do with their money. I keep on saying, we're just taking care of the patients, don't worry about it. They keep on wanting to know more. I don't know why they want to know more, but they keep on wanting to know more. So our patient population is typical of most health centers, a lot of women, a lot of kids, and not a lot of seniors. Large number of our patients want to receive care in a language other than English, mostly Spanish, but probably 40 other languages that we have to serve patients through. This, for our health center, has been a trend where we've had an increasingly Latino population. We continue to have a small African-American population. You know, we always have a few people who refuse to tell us where they fit in this diagram. Our patients, from a payment standpoint, are mostly Medicaid. In fact, to operate our network, only 11% of our services are covered by our federal grant. And were it not for enhanced Medicaid reimbursement through FQHC payments for Medicaid patients, we probably wouldn't be operating anywhere near the size of the network we do. We have a lot of uninsured patients. We hope that's going to change over time. We're still optimistic that nothing's going to happen to that commitment to insure a lot of Americans by 2014. We've been able to develop through our information system a robust set of registries mostly from our data warehouse. So we've been able to pull in a lot of information and a lot of data on our patients who have hypertension, who have diabetes, who need cancer screening, and use that to both tell us how well we're doing and to outreach to patients who are in need of services. A couple of the registries are outside of the data network. Most of them are within the data warehouse that we have. I apologize for this slide. It never shows up right. But what it's supposed to show is that if you take all Denver residents never seen took care of. They're in the small, they're on the bottom. Those patients who've had two or more visits in our primary care delivery system in the last 12 months are the ones we report from a quality standpoint. Those patients who are in our registries who've had one visit in the last 8 months, we consider part of our panel, and that's the patient population that we outreach to bring them in for services. So if you want to know how well I do with colorectal cancer screening, we're going to look at this top group. But if you want to know which patients we think we need to get in for colorectal cancer screening, it's this bigger group. So we do a lot of outreach activities to get those patients in. And we're able, through this data warehouse, to create a quality dashboard, which is an electronic dashboard that's available at all of our sites, where you can look and see at our certain clinic how many kids had five or more well-child visits in the first 15 months of life, or how many patients with diabetes have a hemoglobin A1C less than 9, or how many patients got a breast cancer screen at a recommended interval. We're able to do that for the entire program, and then we're able to drill it down, and we're able to create trend lines over time as to how well we're doing. Like, this is our diabetes LDL for diabetic patients, LDL less than 100, and it looks at our performance from July of 2008 through November of 2009. Actually, this is available electronically on the dashboard, so I could pull it up and see how well we're doing today. I mean, it's constantly being updated from our data warehouse. And we have data not only system-wide, but we also have it by clinic. So we can look at each of our clinics, and we can get a little competition going between our clinics so that we can get some clinics to try to do better than the clinic across town. We could actually do it by provider. So the next set of diagrams that I could pull up is within a clinic, I could say how well each primary care provider in that clinic was doing with their patients with that condition. We've done that for a number of different conditions, and we use that as a way to incent and encourage performance improvement in our health centers. This is our immunization, two-year-old immunization rate. I point out this dropout here was when we didn't have enough DTP vaccine to give 4 doses. So we only gave 3 doses, and then but quickly performance went up when we were able to give 4 doses. I think I said to the last audience, I've only picked out slides where the slope goes upward. I think there may be a few where the slope is straight or maybe even falls off, but I conveniently didn't add those to this presentation. So this is hypertension control, number of patients. This is our goal in purple and our improvement per our registry in red. This is our cervical cancer screening, pap smear in the last 3 years. You can again see goal performance. We have improved performance, I think, most in our cancer screening through the use of patient navigators and community health workers to do outreach and bring patients in, and also by empowering our medical office assistants to tell somebody when they need to have a pap smear and to actually schedule them. So you take everything out of the hands of the doctors and you give it to the nurses and the medical office assistants, and things work just great. You know, so you don't have to worry about mistakes being made. You get real standard work when you don't have the doctors do it. This is colonoscopy screening and our improvement rate there. So you can see for many of the conditions that Ned says have type A or type B recommendations, we're working to improve that. And I would say we're not alone in doing that. This is oral health. And what we're looking at here is we're looking at how many kids under 3 years of age have had the application of a fluoride varnish, many times done in the medical office, not in the dental clinic, or they've seen a dentist in the first 3 years of life. So my point is that there is a tremendous opportunity because we touch patients who are living at risk for not receiving services that they need, that we're able to provide those services, and the infusion of funding that is coming to community health centers should not only increase access to care, but should allow us to increase access to the care that they need. And I think through partnership with health departments, we can make that even happen better, or through community-based organizations. So thank you. We're happy to answer any questions you may have.
So this is your turn. If you'd like to come up to the microphone, and while you're doing that, I will strip this. And And why don't you just go ahead? Thank you.
I would say a couple of things. I didn't present data on how well we think we penetrate into the population in Denver. We've actually done a number of analyses to look at the low-income population and the percentage of the low-income population that we take care of, and to see where there are pockets of low-income residents of Denver that we don't serve. We know we don't take care of everybody. I mean, we take care of about 40% of the we actually take care of about 40% of the children in Denver. So we think we take care of most of the low-income children in Denver, not all. Take care of about 25% of Denver residents in total. So there are pockets of areas where we don't meet the needs. I think the opportunities that we see in healthcare reform are twofold. One is we think we can expand our network to increase access to care. And we hope that through that funding we can, through a combination of funding for infrastructure and increased reimbursement for the uninsured, will be able to meet the needs of a larger population of patients. And I think the other thing that we hope is that we'll be able to better partner with and have more resources to do more public health interventions through our health department that are more population-based and community-based. So we see a lot of opportunities in healthcare reform going forward. We don't meet the needs of everybody. We have a waiting list of patients who would like to get into primary care that we're unable to take care of. So, there are clearly pockets of need that we're not able to address.
Let me answer the question on dentists and then go into a little bit of oral care. So we don't make recommendations to dentists, so there are no dentists on the task force. We will engage oral health experts and dentists when we do a recommendation that bridges over. But to have, to spend a position on a person who's not going to vote on the rest of the, is not going to engage in the rest of the areas, it's just, so we look at experts as people we bring in when we need the expertise, but we like the setup we have. Now, let me then go on to say is that there is an oral health recommendation currently in the portfolio. It's not my favorite recommendation because it doesn't go far enough. It's just saying that kids who don't have fluoride in their water need fluoride supplementation, something that would be evaluated and provided in the primary care clinician setting. However, I've gone to the task force and said we need to start talking about varnishes because that is a primary care deliverable service with good evidence that addresses the number one disease of children. So, and we will engage dental experts when we do that. Right, and so I think the sealant issue is whether or not, and you'd have to tell us whether or not the primary care clinicians, advanced practice nurses and physicians should move into the sealant area as well as the... So that's why I thought we'd just do varnishes.
I'm just going to echo the same here. I think part of what we've seen with school-based health centers is the real recognition of the whole issue around dental. And some of the small changes, you know, in Michigan now it's required to do an exam, has to have an oral exam piece, and they have to have a written protocol on where they're going to refer for follow-up. The dilemma is there's not a lot of places to go for follow-up care. So really, you know, it just depends on how you structure that. The concern I have with that is when I go in and I see the glaring needs of what's happening with oral health and no place to send young people to it, that is almost a disservice in itself as well. So I think there's a larger issue here.
I guess I would say, too, in Colorado, since I've now left my public health hat behind, but we had an active school-based sealant system as well that we're always trying to get more money for so we could expand it.
So we run a school-based sealant program as well. It's been, I think, very, very good program. There's good evidence to back it up. We have a pressing need for restorative services for kids. We now have four of our health centers with dental clinics. So that's four out of eight have dental clinics. We hope to expand that to five in the next year. So I think you're right. I think that's a logical place to do it. And then we also believe that the primary care clinician can do a lot around oral health care. That's why we've instituted this goal around use of fluoride varnishes in our pediatric and family medicine clinics.
Penetrating questions. So let's talk about performance. And there are already some performance improvement incentives built into the ACA, but they're not necessarily around delivery of the service. They're more around the health of the population. I think people envision those and they figure that providing the incentive of first dollar coverage was a good place to start. Eventually, there are placeholders in for patient-centered medical home and accountable care organizations in the Act itself that need to be filled in as requirements rather than just kind of placeholders. And I think that as I talked to one of the Democrats, one of the whips who actually got all the votes, she said, we realized we couldn't get what we wanted. We had to get what we could get, but we put these placeholders in. So I think what you'll see is performance incentives built in more as additional legislation gets layered on. The issue about mental health providers is great because I honestly think that I told the last group that the way the recommendations are written, that all of behavioralist interventions say screen and treat, where the more clinical ones just say screen. And the fact that it says screen and treat means that treatment is covered with first dollar coverage. And I, when they asked me, when we said screen for childhood obesity, that was a big change last year. By the way, you never get criticized for adding something, only for backing off. So when we added that, the criticism was there aren't any programs. And I said, this is the way it always works. You start paying for it, and the programs will be built. So my hope is that you'll see that first dollar coverage will look like an economic opportunity to a mental health system that wants to expand, and that's currently the best we can do. I don't know if you guys...
There's a couple of questions that were asked in the first session. But there's somebody coming up to the microphone.
I actually don't know the answer to that question. I know that many of the health centers have become very electronically, they've implemented electronic health records. Many of them have developed smart business intelligence to pull information out of those records to do some work. The Bureau conducted a program of health disparities collaboratives over a 10-year period where they really encouraged the use of a care model that encouraged the development of registries. So I think many health centers nationwide do have chronic disease registries that they use and they build in different ways. The Bureau is incenting programs to really move towards electronic health records and the use of data to improve performance. The Bureau, I know, has recently contracted with AHRQ to help develop health centers into medical homes. If you look at the medical home certification process, there's a great need. I mean, you need to actually have a lot of electronic information available. You need to develop registries for your high need common conditions. So I think this is the direction that health centers will go over the next few years. How many of them done to date? How many have done to date? I don't know. I can tell you in Colorado, there's an active group among all the health centers in Colorado to start actually pooling data at a central site to report on all the health centers. So we can not only compare internally, but we can compare externally with all the other health centers in the state. And that's been funded with some interesting HIT funding from the federal government. So this is not an uncommon you'll hear this talked about quite a bit among health centers. I can't give you the exact data. You might want to go to NAC and find out if you want specifics.
I want to comment on it because I think school-based health centers in the children that they serve, which is our highest-risk kids in the nation, we have just worked out with the Kresge Foundation to do a survey to create a data warehouse that will start to warehouse the data related to children and adolescents, particularly our highest-risk adolescents, so that we can actually start to do some of this registry stuff and look exactly what the outcomes are around this population. So I hope that this is one area that we can really keep on the burner because I think it will set a direction for how we can quickly intervene in different populations with children and adolescents, which is a different developmental process than it is for adults. So.
Are you talking about health center services? I actually think it does the opposite. If you look at what happened in Massachusetts with Universal... Sorry.
This mic is an illusion. Recording.
I think the question is whether or not healthcare reform threatens the existence of health centers. I think it demands the existence of health centers. If you look at what happened in Massachusetts with healthcare reform, it's the availability of primary care services, once everybody was insured, was abysmal. And it was only through the public sector really creating a lot of increased access that they were able to provide care. I think that's the whole thinking behind the infusion of money to community health centers to try to figure out how to create it. I mean, I'm quite frankly worried about how we're going to be able to meet the needs of the population in Denver. Thinking about it, and we already can't do it, and now people are going to say, I got insurance and I want it. You know, I mean, I think it's going to be a challenge.
So I think we, no, I don't think it threatens at all.
I agree with you, Doctor. We are the public sector this morning or never. My question, I'd love to ask both about school-based health centers and community health centers, but I think a lot of my colleagues in family planning have struggled to partner with S2HC systems. S2HCs are required to do family planning, but their care requirements are not defined. So can you give us some advice, your partners in public health provision, about how we together provide for the needs of reproductive health? There's enormous demand. We are looking at lots of new patients in our system as well. And it seems that your IT systems don't have to provide other service, but can you look for referrals? Do you think there's more of an opportunity to have true partnership between family planning and your IT systems?
Debbie should answer this question as well. I'd be interested to see her perspective. I think the way we look at providing family planning services, that there are opportunities for more collaboration. We think a single point of entry is better. So what we've been inclined to do is try to figure out how to provide a full range of contraceptive family planning services at a single medical home. But we do refer, particularly our school-based, since we're not able to dispense on site at our schools, we actually end up referring a lot of patients to Planned Parenthood or other family planning entities in the state. And then there are other services that we, of course, can't provide that can be provided, family planning services. Therapeutic abortion services is the one that comes to mind the most, where we certainly work very closely with Planned Parenthood clinics to do that. So I think there's always opportunity for more partnership. And I think every community has its own unique needs, and how they end up deciding where it's best to get patients' care is going to really depend upon that community.
From a school-based health center, I think there's really wonderful opportunities to partner and very clear opportunities to partner. And I think the other piece of it, I just had this discussion with CDC on this. For us as F2HCs that operate F2HCs, there's a whole issue around commingling of funds and how to track them separately. And that's been an issue for our school-based health centers as well, who've had natural contracts with, particularly our school-linked ones, have contracts with family planning providers. It's difficult to keep those separate. And you don't get reimbursed a lot of money, quite frankly, for those services. And so I think that's a whole other issue that we all can come together collectively and really argue out. The other piece of it is really getting around systems of care. It may not make sense for us or for me to be doing it. It may make more sense for me to contract with you. There are women who like to go in for confidential services of all ages, and so my job is to make sure that my patient has those access, and that may mean not coming through the doors in a single point. So I see it a little bit differently. I think that's the challenge of healthcare reform, is getting us to think in that way.
Hi, I'm Dan Morrison from the Department of Public Health and Environment here in Colorado. And I'm going to share a plug for a presentation that I'm doing on patient performance, in which we implemented that system in a public health program. And it was sufficient in that we were able to demonstrate increased quality of care outcomes. Our costs went up a little bit, but if you attend the presentation, you'll be able to go into detail.
Are there any last questions before we wrap it up? If not, would you join me in thanking our panelists?